Thank you, Rebecca. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to La Trobe University. Whichever bit of La Trobe University you're in, I'm speaking here from the Melbourne campus at Bundoora, but we have other groups at our major campuses in Bendigo, in Albury Wodonga, and in Mildura. So good afternoon to you all, and in particular, good afternoon to Vancouver. I suppose good evening to Vancouver, where I think the time is now coming up to 8 o'clock in the evening. And I have to say there, good evening and welcome to Dr. David Suzuki, who is the Sir John Quick lecturer for today. And I'll say just a little bit about the lecture we're going to hear in a moment. I'd like, though, just to spend a couple of minutes just saying something about this university. As you know, La Trobe University is now celebrating its 40th anniversary year. We were founded in 1967, and over the last 40 years, the university has clocked up a huge number of achievements, not least the achievements of our 120,000 graduates who have studied in the university and taken their skills, learning, enthusiasm right around the world into the workplaces and communities in which they now find themselves. 40 years ago, this particular campus and this particular site of the university was pretty much a field of mud with two buildings and lots of cranes and cement mixers in it. So over a 40-year period, we can see within this university just what can be achieved if you have the vision and the determination to put that vision into action. But of course, over the last 40 years, we've also seen what, in a sense, what one can fail to do if you don't have the vision and the determination to put ideas into action. And our interactions, humanity's interactions with the environment, I suppose, is one of the great failings of the last 40 years. Let me make the point about the enduring nature of our failing by turning my attention now to Dr. David Takayoshi Suzuki, our very special lecturer for today. David Suzuki was born in 1936. He's, as you know, I think, a Canadian science broadcaster and an environmental activist. Since the mid-1970s, let me stress that date, the mid-1970s, David has been campaigning for the environment and publicising the importance of science and scientific knowledge within the community through a series of books, through his TV and radio series, and in particular as host of the popular and long-running CBC television science magazine, The Nature of Things, which has been syndicated right around the world. So for 40 years, David has been trying to raise people's consciousness about the importance of the environment and the dangers that we as a dominant species on this planet, the dangers that we are running in terms of our careless interactions with the environment. David has been working throughout this period, over the last four decades, to attempt to get people to recognize these problems and to take action to reverse climate change. He co-founded the David Suzuki Foundation in 1990 to work to find ways for society to live in balance with the natural world that sustains us. The foundation's priorities are oceans and sustainable fishing, climate change, clean energy, and sustainability. That foundation was set up in 1990. It's only in the last few years, really in the last handful of years, that I think our political leaders have begun to wake up to the message that David and others over many decades have been issuing, the message that we need to notice what's happening and then take action. I have to say that political leaders in countries have not all taken the same notice of these very important messages. And alas, we have to look, I think, particularly here in Australia, at what political leaders have done to almost ignore some of the very clear scientific findings about climate change until very recently. The same could be said of the United States. We often look to political leaders for just that thing, leadership, but I feel that on the subject of climate change and our responsibilities to the environment, our political masters have been dragging their feet and only grudgingly now are moving along with public sentiment. David received his BA from Amherst College in Massachusetts in 1958, his PhD in zoology from the University of Chicago in 1961, and he was then professor of zoology in the University of British Columbia for almost 40 years until he retired in 2001, and he's now professor emeritus at a university research institute. Over those 40 years when he's been doing a major job teaching, researching in the university, he's also in his spare time found opportunities to write 43 books, including Gen Ethics, Wisdom of the Elders, Inventing the Future, and, I think really very importantly, the best-selling Looking At series of children's science books. Why do I say that's very important? I think if we don't engage with children over the importance of science and try to raise broad understanding and knowledge of scientific issues amongst children, then we will simply replicate what we have today, that is a whole set of political leaders around the world, most of whom gave up the study of science at the age of 14 to focus on their own political careers, and then, of course, find that they face many of the scientific challenges of political office in a state of profound ignorance. For David, for his work in popularising science and his intellectual leadership on environmental issues, has been presented with no fewer than 22 honorary degrees. He's the recipient of Canada's most prestigious award, the Companion of the Order of Canada. He's been awarded the UNESCO Kalinga Prize for Science, and he has also received a long list of Canadian and international honours. But perhaps most significant of all, in 2004, David Suzuki was declared a national treasure by being nominated by CBC viewers as one of the top 10 greatest Canadians of all time. So, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me very great pleasure to welcome a Canadian national treasure, a lifetime campaigner for the environment and for all our futures, Dr. David Suzuki, to address us on the subject, can we avoid the looming ecological Armageddon?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I hope you can get my image there. Do you have it? Hello. I can see you, but can you see me? Good, great. That's great. Thank you. I'm absolutely delighted to be here this evening, well, I guess at noon for you, to deliver the Sir John Quick lecture today. You know, for the past 20 years, I've visited Australia once or twice every year. I've had an absolute passion for Australia, the land, and its people. So it was with great sadness that I realized on my last visit to Australia over a year ago now that it might be my last visit ever to your country. For more than 3 years, I've been flying carbon neutral by buying what we call gold standard offsets that put green energy onto the grid in developing countries. But the Earth is telling us that flying is simply too expensive in terms of the carbon output. So I've reduced my flying by cutting it in half this year, by lumping together commitments instead of spacing them out and flying back and forth and back and forth. And between the three major cities of Toronto, Ottawa, and Montreal, I travel by train. And it turns out to be a wonderful way to get a lot of work done. This is my first full speech by video conference. So I've been a virgin up until now in terms of video conferencing. And if it works out well, and I hope it does, it will replace most of my in-person speaking from next year on. So I want to thank La Trobe University, Australia, for giving me this opportunity to try out this new technology. Over a year ago now, in Canada, the polls indicated that for Canadians, health was a number one concern, and the environment was coming up very rapidly to the number two position. Now, to me, it meant that the environment was at the top, because health and the environment are interlinked. You can't have healthy people if you don't have a healthy planet. But a year and a half ago, I decided to cross Canada in a bus, stopping in communities to talk to them and listen to them about what their concerns were. Now, to show you how stupid I am, I decided to go in February, which is in the heart of winter, and much of the time crossing Canada, I was in 30 below weather. And I know that Australians have no idea what 30 below is. Believe me, it's very, very cold. So I began on February 1st, on the east coast of Canada, and traveled for 30 days across to the west coast. I spoke in 41 communities to more than 30,000 people, and I asked Canadians what they would do for the environment if they were Prime Minister. And we recorded over 600 videos of people telling us what they would do. And what we found in analyzing those 600 videos was that Canadians overwhelmingly value nature as a part of who we are as a people. That Canadians want Canada to meet the Kyoto targets. That Canadians want to invoke a carbon tax to pay for much of what we do to reduce emissions. That Canadians want affordable, efficient public transit. And we want to protect nature. The environment and climate now are the absolute number one priority in Canada. And many people say, aren't you happy? Are you satisfied now? And I say it's a bittersweet moment for me. It's sweet, of course, because the environment has become number one. But it's a bitter moment because we've already been here before. In 1988, the environment around the world was at the absolute top of the agenda. I vividly remember meeting Roz Kelly in 1988, part of the Hawke government, and she was a very, very strong environmental minister at the time. In 1988, George Bush ran for president of the United States and promised, "If you elect me, I will be an environmental president." There wasn't a green bone in his body. The only reason he said that was because the American public demanded it of him. And of course, as soon as he was elected, he became the worst environmental president the United States had ever had. And he remained the worst environmental president until his son was elected. Then he became the number two worst environmental president the U.S. had ever had. In 1988, in Canada, we re-elected a man named Brian Mulroney to be the Prime Minister. And to show his concern about the environment, he elected the biggest politician in his cabinet to the position of Minister of the Environment. He was named Lucien Bouchard. And I interviewed Lucien Bouchard 2 months after he was nominated for the post. I said, "What is the most important issue we face as a country?" And immediately his answer was, global warming. This is 1988. I asked him, how serious an issue is it? And this is his exact answer. It threatens the survival of our species. We have to do something now or we're in deep trouble. 1988. In 1988, a major conference of atmosphere scientists was held in Toronto. And those scientists were so concerned about global warming that they issued a press release at the end of the conference saying that global warming represented a threat to human survival second only to all-out nuclear war. And they called for a 20% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions below 1988 levels in 15 years. Think if we had done it. If we had listened to the scientists and taken their warning seriously and acted on their demand to reduce carbon, we would be so far past Kyoto that it would be a far easier matter to reduce to the level to come into balance with the natural world again. But we didn't do it. And now, 20 years later, the challenge is that much greater and so much more difficult and expensive to achieve some kind of balance. The tragedy of our time is that we didn't pay attention to those early warnings and concerns. My daughter Severn is 27 years old, but she's been an environmental activist since she was 5 years old. I remember coming home from work and finding that she'd set up a table outside our house and was selling my hardcover books for 25 cents a piece. And she was trying to raise money to save the Amazon rainforest, and I think she had raised $10 by the time I put a stop to that. But she's remained an environmental activist all her life. And a few months ago, she said to me, "Dad, I think this is the most exciting moment ever in human history to be alive." And I said, "Well, exciting isn't quite the way I would say it, but why do you think that?" And she said, "Because we've reached a point where we have no choice. We have to make some major decisions now. We can't avoid putting off these decisions, because if we don't make those decisions now, we are in for deep trouble. This is the defining moment for humankind. We have a few years to make major decisions that will determine whether we were a spectacular flash-in-the-pan failure or whether we are truly capable of stepping up and showing the wisdom to do the right things to protect a future for our children." Sounds like a pretty melodramatic statement to say, this is the defining moment. But as I reflect on her words and think on the past, I've had to conclude she's absolutely right. This is the moment. We only have a small window of time when we are going to have to make some major decisions. Think on it. We all know about global warming today. Even Mr. Howard has got the word. I don't know, I think you're in your seventh year of a major drought. Duh! I'm delighted to know there's going to be an election next month in your country. And I hope the environment and climate are the number one issue in this campaign. Please, let's make it that. In Canada, our Prime Minister is paying attention to global warming. Even Mr. Bush is now paying attention to the issue of climate change. That's because it's undeniable that the impact of our increase in greenhouse gases has kicked in and we can see the effects already. But it's far more than just the change in our atmosphere. I interviewed scientists many years ago who worked at the American Research Station at the South Pole, and they told me they can detect toxic chemicals from every part of the planet. In other words, you can't go anywhere on Earth and escape the toxic debris of our industrial might. A few weeks ago, three politicians in Ottawa were tested for 80 different toxic chemicals, and I think the average was 43 toxic chemicals found in the three politicians. So it doesn't matter how you live, you can't avoid the toxic material. It's in our food, our air, and our water. Over 50% of the forests of the planet are gone, And if we continue to log the way and at the rate that we're doing today, in 20 years, there will not be a single large intact forest left on the planet. The United Nations Environment Program's head, Klaus Töpfer, says that every year 55,000 species of plants and animals go extinct. Many years ago, we heard that over 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, and they're not coming back. And I could go down a list of many more things that tell us we are at a crucial point now where human activity is undermining the very life support systems of the planet. That's what is the defining moment now when we have to make some major changes. How did we get to this moment when all of these issues are coming together? Scientists use DNA probes to analyze the history of our species, and they tell us that human beings arose as a new species about 200,000 years ago in Africa. I want you to try to imagine what the world was like 200,000 years ago. There were still mammoths roaming the planet. There were saber-toothed tigers, 9-foot-tall moa birds, and giant sloths all over North America. The world was a very different place when our species was born. If you try to imagine that the room you're sitting in is a giant time machine and we can transport ourselves back 200,000 years and perch above the Rift Valley in Africa and look down on the great plains of the Serengeti. Imagine, if you've ever been to the Serengeti, you know what an amazing place it is. But it's nothing today with what it must have been 200,000 years ago. There would have been herds of immense creatures as far as you could see from horizon to horizon. And if we look carefully 200,000 years ago, here and there we would see little clusters of 2, 3, 4 of these funny-looking two-legged furless apes. And that was us. You got to admit, looking at us in the context of all of the other animals across the plains of Africa, we weren't very impressive. I mean, there weren't very many of us. We weren't very big. We weren't very fast. An elephant can outrun the fastest human on Earth. We weren't very strong. A chimpanzee weighing 100 pounds could beat the crap out of any one of us. And certainly, you know, look at the people with glasses, or we weren't endowed with special senses of vision or hearing or smell. Who would have ever thought 200,000 years ago, look at that naked ape, they're going to take over the planet? No one could have imagined that 200,000 years ago. But of course, if we watched that creature for any length of time, sooner or later we'd say, ah, look at that. There's the secret. By looking at the behavior of that naked ape, we would see we were intelligent. It was the human brain that was the secret weapon that gave us an advantage over all these other magnificent creatures. The human brain endowed us with a massive memory. No other animal has a memory capacity of the human brain. We were curious and we were inventive. And those were attributes that more than compensated for our lack of physical and sensory ability. And that human brain did something very special. It invented an idea called the future. The future doesn't exist. The only thing that's real is now and our memory of what happened in the past. But the human brain invented the idea of a future. And because of that invention, we are the only animal that realized we can affect the future by what we do today. If we look ahead, we can see where the dangers lie, we can see where there are opportunities, and we can deliberately act today to avoid the dangers and exploit the opportunities. I believe that foresight was our great advantage over all other creatures. Foresight gave us an advantage no other creature had, and by using our foresight, it brought us to where we are today. Today we are the dominant animal on the planet. And I love to tell Australians, there are more of us than all of the rabbits on the planet. You know right away, that is one hell of a lot of human beings. There are more of us than all the rats in the world, than all of the mice in the world. We are the most numerous mammal on the planet. We have become the dominant creature on Earth. And that is because of our use of foresight. And you can, I'm not a Christian, but I have read parts of the Bible, and you look at the great books of learning from the past, and you can see the emphasis on foresight. Some of the parables in the Bible, remember Joseph, the son of Jacob, who married Leah and Rachel, the two sisters, and Joseph was a beautiful one, and everybody loved him, but his brothers and sisters were jealous of him, and when the dad gave him a coat of many colors, the kids sold him off to Egypt. But in Egypt, he became a favorite of the Pharaoh, and one day he came to the Pharaoh and said, I've had a dream, and I think there's going to be a famine coming, and we better start saving up to protect ourselves against that famine. And because the Pharaoh trusted Joseph, he began to store massive amounts of grain. And sure enough, a famine came, and then another famine, and another year. And for 7 years, because Joseph looked ahead, saw the dangers, they were able to survive. Same thing with Noah. You remember Noah was a carpenter. He suddenly heard a voice that said, build an ark. And Noah said, why? Well, I'm only a carpenter. If I do that, my neighbors will make fun of me. And the voice said, Noah, build an ark. There's a flood coming. And put the animals in it 2 by 2. And because Noah looked ahead, or at least was told to look ahead, and built the ark, humans and those many animals survived. Those are all parables, I believe, emphasizing the importance of foresight, of looking ahead and avoiding danger. So now we have come to this position of dominance on the planet. And we have all of the increased ability to look ahead. We have computers and scientists and engineers and telecommunications. And for over 40 years, the leading scientists of the world have been telling us we're heading down a very dangerous path. Let me show you or read to you from one of the remarkable documents in the last 40 years. This is a document called World Scientists Warning to Humanity. And when you look at it, you can't see this, but there are 1,600 scientists who've signed this document. And these are not second or third rate scientists like me. These are the top scientists in the world. Over half of all living Nobel Prize winners in 1992 signed this document. What were the world scientists warning us about? Let me read to you a few lines. Human beings and the natural world are on a collision course. Human activities inflict harsh and often irreversible damage on the environment and on critical resources. If not checked, many of our current practices put at serious risk the future we wish for human society and may so alter the living world that it will be unable to sustain life in the manner that we know. Fundamental changes are urgent. If we are to avoid the collision our present course will bring about. And then they go on and list the areas of collision: the atmosphere, water resources, ocean, soil, forests, species extinction, and overpopulation. And then the words grow even more bleak. No more than one or a few decades remain before the chance to avert the threats we now confront will be lost, and the prospects for humanity immeasurably diminished. A great change in our stewardship of the earth and life on it is required if vast human misery is to be avoided and our global home on this planet is not to be irretrievably mutilated. And then they list the 5 points that have to be begun immediately. This is a frightening document. Scientists of this stature are not in the business of signing such strongly worded documents. So when you get over half of all Nobel Prize winners telling us we could have as little as 10 years to avoid a catastrophe, you got to take this seriously. This came out in November 1992. But if this document is frightening, the response of the media around the world was terrifying. There was no response. In Canada, our national broadcaster, CBC, our national newspaper, The Globe and Mail, didn't bother to report it. In the United States, none of the major American television networks covered it. And I know for a fact that the New York Times and the Washington Post both said this is not newsworthy and didn't bother to report it. Excuse me? half of all Nobel Prize winners, saying we could have as little as 10 years to avoid catastrophe, and this is not newsworthy? What the hell do these media think is newsworthy? I want to remind you, even the eminent New York Times. You ever heard of a guy named O.J. Simpson? You ever heard of Bill and Monica, Martha Stewart, Michael Jackson, Brad and Angelina? These folks and their antics, the media were obsessed with them, not for days or weeks, but for months and years. And I guarantee you, not one of those people or their frolicking will have any historical significance. And yet, half of all Nobel Prize winners warning us are considered not newsworthy. That, ladies and gentlemen, must be considered terrifying. I don't normally sit on international groups because for me it's a waste of time. But 5 years ago, I did accept a United Nations appointment to the board of a group called the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. It was to be the largest study ever done of the state of the world's ecosystems. And I joined this board because I knew the results would be terrifying, and I needed that information to go out and make my case. And sure enough, 4 years later, after $24 million were spent involving 1,200 scientists from 61 countries, the final reports came in, and they are frightening. They are frightening because we are undermining the very ecosystems that keep us alive and healthy. And it was an urgent call to action from these scientists. We released the report at the United Nations in New York. Kofi Annan was present. And in Canada, it was reported on page 3 of our national newspaper. The very next day, the Pope went to the hospital sick, and the Pope's illness, his death, and his succession pushed everything else out of the media. So the biggest study ever done of the state of the planet, a study in which the results were terrifying and an urgent call to action, was in Canada a one-day page 3 wonder, and that was it. So what I see us doing then is turning our backs on the very strategy that got us to where we are today. Our scientists are now looking ahead. They've been warning us for over 40 years we're heading down a very dangerous path. They've been telling us what we can do to avoid disaster. And now, at this moment, we are turning our backs on those warnings. Well, you might say, we don't need to anymore. We're so smart. We've got so much science and technology. When a problem comes up, we'll solve the problem. I just want to remind you that for over 30 years, some of the leading scientists in the United States warned us that New Orleans was a disaster waiting to happen. New Orleans is built in the heart of hurricane country. Every year there's a hurricane season. Half the city is below sea level. Scientists said there is bound to be a Force 5 hurricane. And if you want to avoid disaster, this is what has to be done. And politicians at the local, at the state and federal level said, oh, we can't do that. It'll ruin the economy. We can't afford to do it. So they didn't act on what the scientists said, and you all know the consequence. Hurricane Katrina came, and everything that scientists anticipated happened. Foresight was never more important than it is today, because we are headed down a very dangerous path. What is the problem? What is the concern that scientists are now expressing? I began my career in both the media and in environmental activism in 1962. I was just starting my own scientific career, and along came a woman and completely sidetracked me. Now, that's happened to me ever since puberty, but in this case, I've been ever grateful to her for doing this. My greatest regret is I never met her. She died 2 years later. But she had as great an effect on my life as any woman I've ever known. In 1962, a woman named Rachel Carson published a book called Silent Spring, and it was all about the unexpected effects of pesticides. It's hard for you today to imagine what the world was like in 1962. When her book came out, there was not a single department or minister of the environment in any government on the planet. In 1962, when you said environment, it didn't have anything like the meaning that it does today. Rachel Carson put the environment on the map. And for me, Rachel Carson's book was an absolute shock. And I was swept up in the environmental movement. I also had a scientific career, but it changed the way I looked at the world. And as I was swept up in issues in Canada, I thought the problem was that humans were taking too much stuff out of the environment and putting too much waste and toxic material back into it. So the solution is we need to have departments of the environment. We need regulation. We need Clean Air Acts and Endangered Species Acts and Clean Water Acts. And so a lot of us were campaigning to get these kinds of departments and legislation and to enforce the legislation. But by the early 1970s, I realized it won't work. We don't know enough to be able to legislate the proper things. And I realized that one of the problems is that science, most of science is done by a method called reductionism. We focus on a part of nature. We don't look at the whole picture. We look at a part of it. We look at a subatomic particle, an atom, a molecule, a cell, an organism. We try to isolate that bit of nature. We bring it in the lab. We control everything impinging on it. We measure everything in it. And we acquire tremendous understanding of that part of nature. And it allows us to manipulate that bit of nature. We've split atoms and released energy. We've understood the genetic code and manipulated genes. The problem is, when we remove a part of nature from its context, we no longer see where that part of nature belongs. We don't see how it interacts with the rest of nature. We don't see the rhythms and the patterns and the cycles that impinge on that part of nature. So we can manipulate that nature, bit of nature, but we have no idea what will happen out in the real world. And over again, this we are surprised. With DDT, no one anticipated there was a phenomenon called biomagnification, where DDT is concentrated up the food chain. So by the time you get to the breasts of women or the shell glands of birds, you've concentrated DDT hundreds of thousands of times. We only discovered biomagnification when eagles began to disappear and scientists tracked it down. CFCs. Who could have imagined that CFCs would drift up into the upper atmosphere, chlorine would break off and begin to scavenge ozone? Most of us didn't even know there was an ozone layer up there to break down. No one anticipated CFC effects. And believe me, exactly the same thing will happen with genetically modified organisms. We can do wonderful manipulations in the lab and in test tubes, but we no longer have any sense of what those manipulations will do out in the real world. For me, this was a crisis of understanding. How could we regulate these powerful new technologies when we had no idea what the ramifications would be out in the real world? I came to an understanding of a different way of seeing things in the late 1970s when I became involved in working with what we call First Nations people. Americans call them Native Americans. They used to be called Indians. It's no longer politically correct to call them Indians. They're First Nations people, Aboriginal people. As I worked with Canada's First Nations, I listened to what they were saying, and they referred to the earth as our mother. And I used to say, oh yeah, that's a nice way to say it. And they'd say, listen, Suzuki, you don't get it. We're not speaking metaphorically or poetically. We mean it literally. We are born out of the earth because we are created by the four sacred elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And as I've learned from my First Nations brothers and sisters, I've come to understand that we environmentalists had framed the problem the wrong way. There's no environment out there and we are here and we have to regulate our interaction with it. We are literally the environment. So whatever we're doing out there, we're doing directly to ourselves. Now that may seem kind of weird to you, so let me explain very quickly what I mean. The very first thing every one of us needed the minute we left our mother's body was a breath of air. And from that moment on, 15 to 40 times a minute we need air until the last breath we take before we die. We don't even think about it. But for the next minute, I'd like you to think about what we're doing. You go, and that's very easy. 2 to 4 liters of air deep down into the most moist, intimate, warm parts of our bodies. What are those funny organs that the air enters? Our lungs. You know, if you've ever gone to a butcher shop and seen lungs, and they're all kind of yucky, squishy. They feel funny because they're mainly air. There are about 300 million little capsules or alveoli clustered like grapes around an alveolar stem. So we have all of these little capsules to give the surface area to come into contact with the air. If you flatten the lungs, the alveoli, out into two dimensions, they would cover a tennis court. That's how much surface is all wrinkled up into our lungs. And each alveolus is lined with a three-layered membrane called a surfactant, which reduces surface tension, so when the air comes into the alveolus, it fuses to the surfactant. Instantly, carbon dioxide rushes out, oxygen and whatever else is in the air rushes in, hemoglobin molecules grab onto the oxygen, and with each beat of our heart, that oxygen is pumped to every part of our bodies. And when we exhale, we don't exhale all of the air in our lungs. If they did that, our lungs would collapse. About half of the air stays in our lungs even when we breathe out. So the point I'm making is you can't draw a line and say the air ends here and I begin there. There is no line. The air is in us, it's stuck to us, and it's circulating throughout our bodies. I am air, and you are air. It's in us, it's running through us, it's all around us. And if I am air and you are air, then I am you. Because the air that goes out of my nose, it will very quickly mix in this room, take a bit of time, but it'll eventually get to Australia so that you'll be breathing air that I breathed here in this studio in Vancouver. And if I am you, it's not just that we're linked together with air. Air is not a vacuum or empty space. It's a physical substance that links us all together, but with the birds and the trees and the worms and the snakes, all of us are embedded in a matrix of air. So we are air. Whatever we do to the air, we're doing directly to ourselves. There's a wonderful thought exercise the American astronomer Harlow Shapley does. He said, I want to follow one breath of air. What happens to it? How do you do that? 98% of the air is oxygen and nitrogen. You breathe the air in, oxygen, nitrogen go into your body, breathe it out. A lot of the oxygen stays in our bodies. That's why we need air every minute of our lives. Some of the oxygen, nitrogen, which is 80% of the air, some of it reacts chemically and stays in our bodies. But 1% of the air is an element called argon. And you all remember your high school chemistry that argon belongs to a class of atoms that do not react chemically at all. They're chemically inert. So you breathe it in, argon goes into your body, you breathe it out it comes right back out in the air. So argon is a very good marker for the air, 1% of the air. How many atoms of argon in one breath of air? Shapley calculates 3 × 10⁻⁷ power. That's 3 followed by 18 zeros. Take it from me, that is a lot of argon, okay? So if there was someone else in this studio and we followed one breath coming out of my nose, within minutes that other person would be breathing gazillions of argon atoms that were once a part of my body. But the door is open. Eventually that one breath will go across Vancouver, across the Pacific Ocean. And according to Shapley, 1 year later, every breath you take would have about 15 argon atoms from that one original breath I took a year ago. And that includes all of you in Australia would be breathing about 15 argon atoms that I breathed out a year before. So on that basis, Shapley calculates every breath you take has millions of argon atoms that were once in the bodies of Joan of Arc and Jesus Christ. That every breath you take has millions of argon atoms that were parts of dinosaurs 65 million years ago. That every breath you take will suffuse life forms as far as we can see out into the future. So air is this wonderful substance this sacred element that gives life to all living creatures today and that connects us to the past and into the future as far as we can see. So that's why First Nations people refer to air as a sacred element, a sacred substance. You know, we boast that we're intelligent. We're a clever animal. But what intelligent creature, knowing the importance of air in the lives of all living creatures, would then proceed to use air as a toxic dump and think that somehow it's going to diffuse away and not affect us? We are air. Whatever we do to the air, we do to ourselves. And it really hurts me when I see young couples trying to be environmentally responsible by walking instead of riding their cars, and they've got a baby in a stroller, and that baby's nose is right at the level of the exhaust pipes of our cars. What do we think's happening? Our cars breathe out and go straight up the noses of our children. No wonder kids in Australia and Canada, 15% of them are born with asthma, and that number is rising catastrophically. We are air. Whatever we do to the air, we do directly to ourselves. We are water. You all know that we're over 60% water by weight. We're basically a big blob of water with enough thickener added we don't dribble away on the floor. And we got to drink water all the time to top up because it leaks out of our skin and our eyes and our mouth and our crotch. And we've got to keep topping up. And that water comes from all over the planet. So we are water. Whatever we do to the water, we do to ourselves. We are the earth because most of the food that we eat comes from the soil. And we not only use the soil to dump our toxic chemicals, we spray some of the most toxic chemicals directly onto the food or even inject it into the animals that we're going to eat. We are the earth. Whatever we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. And of course, we're fire. Every bit of the energy in our bodies was once sunlight. Sunlight captured by photosynthesis. So this is the insight that I've gained from my First Nations brothers and sisters, and come to understand that if we're going to approach the problem of the environment, it has to do with the fact that we are using the air, water, and soil that is us in a most destructive way. And that's the crisis that we face. Why can't we see the problem? Well, I'm afraid I don't have the time to go into this, but there are a number of things that I think today blind us to the reality of this so-called environmental crisis. Let me just run through them very quickly. Population growth. Population is skyrocketing. Nothing can just skyrocket in the way that it's going on now. And I'm not going to talk about limits to how many people there are. You know that as population skyrockets, it's going to hit limits and crash. It has to. It can't continue to rise in the way that it is. But the important thing is, as population rises very, very quickly, it means that every year the average age of the world's population gets younger and younger. Well, so what? It means that in Canada and Australia and in the rest of the world, most people alive were born after 1950. Well, again, so what? It means that you've lived your entire lives in an absolutely unprecedented and a totally unsustainable period of growth and change. But that's all you've ever known. To you, this is what normality is. And to you, this is what's got to be maintained. This huge rate of growth and change. You demand it because that's all you've ever known and that's what is normal. So there's a real shift in the way that we perceive the world. And the tragedy of our time is that there is a group of people that remember how we lived in a very different way before all of this massive growth and change. They're called our elders. And in First Nations communities, elders are revered. They're like rock stars. But in industrial society, we tend to think of elders as a pain in the neck. We just want to get them into a retirement home, get them away from here. They don't even know how to use email or faxes or iPods. You know, we kind of make fun of them. And yet, they have the memory of a world that was radically different, when the word disposable was not an acceptable word. I think disposable ought to be as bad as saying some naughty words, some four-letter words. We ought to cover our children's ears when we say disposable, because it's not an acceptable thing. And yet, our elders could tell us how we lived rich, full lives in a very different way. We need our elders. Science and technology are a part of what blinds us to the way the world is, because as I explained to you, most of science is reductionist. We focus on a part of nature and we lose sight of the whole picture. We need a new kind of science, systems analysis. We need a new kind of technology called biomimicry, that instead of trying to overwhelm nature with our powerful technologies, tries to copy nature, to mimic the way nature has learned to do things over 4 billion years. But right now, most of science, especially in my area of genetics, is reductionist, and we have no idea what our manipulations, how they will reverberate out in the natural world. And any scientist that tells you they know that genetic manipulation is safe, don't worry about it, is either very, very ignorant or they're deliberately lying to you. We've got an information explosion that I believe, rather than edifying us, tends to blind us. And the reason is most people are overwhelmed with information and they can find anything they want to believe. If you want to believe in intelligent design, there are dozens of websites out there. You want to believe in UFOs that came to Earth and raped women and had babies? There's a website for it. You want to believe the Earth is flat? There's a website. Pyramid Power, Bermuda Triangles, it's all out there. When I give lectures on global warming, I'm always encountering somebody that says at the end, "You're full of baloney. We're going into global cooling. We should be burning more fossil fuel." And when I say, "Well, how do you know that?" They say, "Well, I found a website." Well, yeah, there are dozens of websites saying that climate change is junk science, this is baloney, it's part of a natural cycle. But guess who's funding the website? You got to find out who's putting that information out. It's the fossil fuel companies. So we've got to be very much more critical about information. And when you look at the popular media, my bet is if you read The Australian or the Age, you'll find in a single day of newspaper, you'll find a report about prolonged drought in West Australia, floods in Bangladesh, a famine in Ethiopia, and drying out jungles or rainforests in Brazil. And they're all reported as if they've got nothing to do with each other. And yet there is an underlying theme that would make sense of these disparate things that are going on in the world. But the way that we consume information is in bits and pieces without being able to see the whole picture. So I think information itself is a part of the problem because there's so much of it out there. I'd like to just mention two important things, though. One is a fundamental shift in the way that we live. In 1900, there were 1.5 billion people in the world. There were only 14 cities with 1 million people or more. London was the largest with 6.5 million people. Tokyo was the 7th largest city with 1.5 million people. In 1900, most human beings lived in agricultural village communities. We were a farming species. Cut ahead only 100 years. Now there are 6 billion people in the world in the year 2000, but there are more than 400 cities with more than 1 million people. The 10 largest cities all have more than 11 million people. Tokyo is the largest city in the year 2000 with 26 million people. Can you imagine going from 1.5 million to 26 million in only 100 years? And if you've ever been to Tokyo, you know, human beings shouldn't live that way. We didn't evolve to live in big cities like Tokyo or Shanghai or New York or London. This isn't the way we evolved to live. But we have now become an urban, a large urban dwelling creature. And in a city, it's easy to think we're different from other creatures. We're so intelligent, we create our own habitat, and now the economy becomes the most important thing. Because, of course, the economy delivers clean water and all of the things in our stores and plentiful electricity and takes away our sewage and garbage. But, of course, it's the earth that gives us those things or absorbs our waste when we're done. But we think, no, it's the economy that makes it all possible. And in a city, our perceptions are distorted, and we no longer recognize that, like any other living creature, we are as dependent on clean air, clean water, clean energy, and clean soil as any other creature. We forget that. And finally, I think the major disconnector is the thing all of our so-called leaders in politics and business tell us is the bottom line, the most important thing going, and that is the economy. The economy itself is a human construct. How could we think, if you read the business pages of the newspaper, you'd swear the economy is a thing. Oh, the economy's not feeling too good today. It must have woken up from a hard night out or something. But, oh, yes, or the Australian dollar, you know, it's showing signs of strong growth. We treat the marketplace as if it's some kind of magic creature. You know, 300 years ago, we believed in dragons and ghosts, and we sacrificed virgins to appease them. Well, today we don't have virgins, but we now have the economy to worry about, you know, and the economy has become our equivalent of dragons 300 years ago. But the economy was made by human beings. And the economy, how come it begins to set or dictate everything that we do? We're animals. And as animals, we depend on that thin layer called the biosphere around the planet. The biosphere is fixed. It can't grow. And it's very, very thin. That zone of air, water, and land where life exists, if we reduced the Earth to the size of a basketball, the biosphere would be thinner than a layer of plastic sandwich wrap. And that's it. That's where everything goes on that's alive. It can't grow. And yet economists think that the economy can grow forever. Not only do they think it can, which it cannot, but that it must grow forever. Nothing in a finite world can grow forever. Just want to remind you how tiny one cell is in the human body. There are about 60 trillion cells in our body. If one cell suddenly is mutated to a cancerous state, that cancer cell thinks, I'm only one cell out of 60 trillion. That's insignificant. I can just keep growing. And guess what? They start chugging along and dividing. And you know what happens. Nothing can grow forever in a finite body. And it kills us if we don't kill that cancer. And yet we allow economists to run rampant and tell us that steady growth is possible and absolutely critical to our well-being. It is not. It is not possible, and if we keep running after this steady growth, we never ask the important questions. What's an economy for? How much is enough? Are we happier with all of this economic growth? We're not asking the important questions because we're blinded by that economy. Now, I very quickly want to answer the question, can we avoid the catastrophe that scientists are telling us we're headed towards? Well, every day it becomes that much more difficult, especially if 65,000 species are disappearing every year. The web of life, which is the very thing on which we depend for our well-being and our health, the web of life is becoming far less resilient as we lose bits and pieces of that complex web. Can we find a sustainable way of living? I have no idea. We've so undermined the life support systems that they're no longer predictable or reliable. But if we carry on the way we are in terms of creation of greenhouse gases, we know that our children, but especially our grandchildren, are in for very, very unsettling times. And because of that concern, I ask the question, are there solutions out there? Are there solutions to all of these problems of climate change, of deforestation, of loss of fish in the oceans? So many years ago, I set out to find whether individuals, companies, organizations, and governments are actually able to find ways of living in a different way. And when I began the research, I must admit, I thought I might end up with a very skinny book. To my amazement, we could have probably written 6 or 7 books. We wrote one thick book. Holly Dressel and I wrote a book which we called Good News for a Change, Hope for a Troubled Planet. And it's filled with examples of what individuals, companies, organizations, and governments are doing. The good news is there are lots of solutions out there. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just have to look at where they're going on and then try to copy them. The bad news is our so-called leaders don't seem to be very interested. I sent a copy of Good News for a Change to every politician in Ottawa and to the CEOs of the 100 largest companies in Canada. And I included a note saying, I'm sending you this book as a gift. Please don't bother to write to thank me. I want you to read it. And if you've read it and you find something that you want to continue to follow up on, then please write to me because I'm very interested. I won't depress you with how few of those letters I got back. The good news is there's lots of good news out there. The bad news is our leaders don't want to change. They want to do things the same old way. Oh, they'll put a bandage on here and there, but they don't want to be deflected onto what could be a truly sustainable path. So that's why we decided, let's go to the public, let's go to the people and say, we're going to get started and show our leaders by our examples that we're going to do make a difference. So we focused on how do ordinary people impact the most on the environment. And very quickly it was obvious, it's what we eat, where we live, and how we move. So focusing on food, housing, and transportation, we came up with a list of the 10 most effective things that each of us can do to lighten our ecological footprint. We have more than 355,000 Canadians who have voluntarily signed up to do at least three of these three steps. We call them the Nature Challenge, who have taken the Nature Challenge. I'm looking to try to get a million people to sign up because I believe that number will have a tipping effect to get us all over doing the thing. And we, by our example, will show government and corporations that we want them to do their share as well. And finally, in our battles with government, with politicians and with corporations, what I find is they're focused on a very short vision. Corporations are worried about the bottom line, which is the quarterly or the annual report. Politicians are worried about the next election. So a few years ago, we said, let's get away from this short-term thinking. Let's look ahead. What kind of a Canada do we want in a generation, in 25 or 30 years? How about a Canada where the air is clean and 15% of kids don't get asthma? How about a Canada that's covered with forests that we're logging all the time because we're doing it the right way? A Canada where you could drink the water out of any river or lake, catch a fish and eat it, and not worry about what's in it. When you define a vision that way, guess what? Everybody agrees. Yes, of course that's what we would like Canada to be. I've taken it to the business community. I've taken it to the mayors of cities in Canada. I've taken it to the multi-faith community. And everybody says, of course, that's what we would like. Well, now you've done two things. By looking ahead, we now are no longer fighting. Everybody is on the same side. So we're all working together. And we now have a target to aim at. We know where we're going. So if a developer comes and says, I'd like to get a license to do this development, you say, does that get us closer to the target or further away? If it gets us closer, great, go for it. If it gets us further away, we say, sorry, come back again with a different idea. So now we know where we're going, and that gives us a direction that is very powerful. Can we achieve it? We've divided our activities into 9 categories of energy, waste, food, forests, water, 9 different categories, and we believe in every single category we can achieve the target if we start now and we have concrete targets to achieve at year 1, at year 2, at year 5, at year 10. We believe we can achieve what we call sustainability within a generation. We've shared this with the Australian Conservation Foundation, and they are making an Australian version. We're making an American version in the United States. And it's a very powerful document, a way of looking ahead, coming together, and then getting on with working towards that common future. Yes, I believe it is achievable, but it means we have to start now, and we have to start with a sense of urgency. Thank you very much. I don't know where we go from here. I can see you. I hope you can see me.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure if this is on. David, can you hear
it
me?
It is, and I can hear you.
Great. Thank you very much. That's been an inspirational lecture. I think, you know, here in Australia, where we're facing the seventh year of drought, though I should say it's actually raining outside at present, so we could all be pleased about that. Unfortunately, it's not raining very hard. But in the seventh year of drought, we're all very, very aware of the huge environmental challenge that's bearing down on us, and particularly concerned about the fact that so far we're now into the second week of an election campaign, and our political leaders seem to have been just about silent on the issue of the environment to date. So we've clearly got to move them forward. Now, across our various campuses, there are a number of people who have put forward some questions. I hope you've got a little bit of time and you're prepared to listen to these questions and give us some responses. The questions are all being routed through me because we can't set up a set of roving microphones across all our campuses. But David, one question, in fact quite a few have come in from Bendigo, which all a number of them focus on this issue of responsibility, of who can actually get something done, because there's a huge sort of sense of powerlessness. I suppose political scientists would say, oh, it's the collective action problem. We all know what we would like to do, but you know, unless we all do it at the same time, it's difficult to get things going. Terry Davidson in Bendigo has said, can the United Nations manage the global treatment of the impending disaster? And if not them, who?
Well, I think this is a very good issue to raise, because certainly I find myself and many of my friends who've been in this activity now for far too long, there's often a sense of despair that sweeps over us. My sense is that when you think, you see, we used to say in the 1970s and 80s, think globally and act locally. And I think that was a mistake, because when people think globally, it is so huge, we feel absolutely insignificant and powerless. So I really agree with Thomas Berry, who says, think locally and act locally in order to have any hope of being effective globally. So focus locally, and you can see things that can be done there. Remember, every one of us is a drop in the bucket. But if we have enough drops, I believe we can fill any bucket there is. Now, the Nature Challenge is our attempt to provide people with some idea of things that they can do in a small way that is very, very effective. But even if all Canadians were doing all 10 of the Nature Challenge, it's still not enough, because what about the corporations? The corporations are very, very powerful. And what we need desperately in Canada, Australia, and the United States is leadership and courage on the part of our political leaders. Governments don't have many instruments at their disposal to affect behavior, but they do have two very, very powerful tools. One is taxation. We need a carbon tax, and stop trying to avoid that because the industrial world has demonized the word carbon tax. Why are we allowed to pour carbon into the atmosphere as if it's free? We pay in Canada $90 a ton to dispose of stuff in landfills, and yet we allow carbon to be dumped into the atmosphere for nothing. We need a carbon tax. If people don't like to call it a carbon tax, let's call it a pollution tax. But we need a carbon tax. So we need legislation. We need to use taxation creatively. Tax the things that we don't want, like pollution, and pull back on taxes on things that we want, like income, like salaries. Let's start being creative in the way that we use taxation. We know that it works. Let's also set some hard targets. Stop shying away from regulation. After the APEC meeting in Sydney, what did our Prime Minister boast? Oh, we're now leading the world in meeting climate change. We now have aspirational goals. What the hell is an aspirational goal? It sounds to me like, oh, please, 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 please be nice, guys. Please try to redo. That never works. That's just voluntary compliance, and it doesn't work. We need governments to set hard targets and to enforce the meeting of those targets. The United Nations Framework on Climate is the only international process that we had to try to begin to set those targets. And I regret that Australia never Australia was given a much lighter target than any of the other industrial countries, and yet your government has refused to be a part of that process. My government, on the other hand, ratified Kyoto and then didn't bother to try to meet it, and we know the United States never entered into it. We need to stay with the United Nations framework because it's the only international process that we have right now. But right now, there has been far too much foot dragging. The problems are infinitely more difficult today than they were 20 years ago.
Just to then follow up on that, David, a question from Harry Clark here in Melbourne, which in a sense picks up on this issue of responsibility, because Harry says, what specifically should be done about China and developing countries? Because if we don't focus on those, we won't really address the global issue.
In 1997, when Kyoto took place, I was there. And China was there, and India was there. The industrialized world acknowledged that we had created the problem in the first place. It was our industrial growth that had filled up the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. And therefore, it was our responsibility. We couldn't tell the developing world, don't do what we've already done. We agreed it was our responsibility to cap our emissions and begin to bring them down to a very, very modest target of a 6% reduction below 1990 levels by the year 2010-2012. Australia, on the other hand, is the only country that was given an increase above 1990 levels as a target. The reason that we did that was we had to allow the developing world to grow in their economies, to increase their quality of life, while we would show that we were reducing our emissions. If we don't meet those targets, and by the way, 30 out of the 34 countries that ratified Kyoto are going to meet the target, if we don't meet those targets, if Canada just gives up on it and doesn't meet the target, why should India or Australia or China or Brazil or Indonesia, why should they pay any attention to it? We created the problem. We continue to be the major contributors to the problem, and we're not doing anything about it. We've got to lead by example, and if we don't, I don't see why the Chinese or Indians should pay any attention to us. China is very soon, if not already, going to surpass the United States in total emissions of greenhouse gases, but the only equitable way is to look at the per capita basis of emissions, and by that criterion, China is 3 to 4 times less emitting per person than is the United States or Canada. So we've got to show by our example that we're reducing.
We've got to show by example, and so a question from Alison Lugg in Bendigo. Do we have in higher education institutions, in universities around the world, do we have particular responsibilities and particular opportunities to address this ecological crisis?
Well, it's interesting that I think a lot of the environmental movement has been fueled by students in universities and certain of the faculty. I think one of the problems we face is that universities should be the area where you get some of the leading scientists acting with foresight, looking ahead, telling society what lies ahead, and being leaders in trying to work out alternative ways of living. Too often, though, I think in universities there has been a very, very unhealthy tie between the corporate sector and scientists. And
some support for you here. Lost the feed.
Thank you.
Okay, we're trying to get a connection back.
Hello, we went blank for a while. Are we
Hello.
Connected again?
Yeah, we're back. Thanks, David.
Okay. So I have totally forgotten what the question was. I'm sorry.
It was about particular responsibilities in universities that we have to address.
I think there is an unhealthy linkage now between the corporate sector and university professors. And let me give you one example. In the 1970s, after the Arab oil embargo, it was a very frightening time because immediately the price of oil skyrocketed in equivalent dollars to today's dollar. It was much higher than $88 a barrel back in the mid-1970s. And so there was a tremendous rush to try to exploit the tar sands, one of the largest deposits of oil anywhere in the world, in Alberta. Now, there was one plant at that time that was producing 100,000 barrels of oil a day, but it produced 50 tons of sulfur dioxide a day as well, which is a lot of acid rain. And Mr. Lougheed, the premier at the time, was calling for 10 more plants bigger than the Syncrude plant that was there. And so we decided to do a television program on this. And I went to the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Lots of ecologists. None of them would talk to me on camera. I then went to the University of Calgary, lots of ecologists. None of them would talk to me on camera. And it turned out the reason was they were all receiving grant money from the oil industry, and they didn't want to jeopardize that grant money. And so they refused to talk to the public. I believe, as academics with tenure, they have a responsibility to share their knowledge with the public. But that tie-in with business, and I see it in the area of genetic engineering as well, is a very, very unhealthy linkage. And that's made the universities a much more secretive place than it should be.
David. David, thank you very much. I know we have to end things here at this end and at Bendigo in Albury-Wodonga and Mildura across our university campuses. I want to say again, thank you very, very much for your fantastic lecture, for responding so openly and frankly to the questions, and I think for inspiring everyone here in the audience. I hope everyone goes away and logs on to the Australian Conservation Foundation website to see exactly what each and every one of us can do to do our little bit, our local bit, to support the environment. David, we have we always present a certificate to the Sir John Quick lecturers. I can't present it to you physically. I could put it in the post. That would use up a little bit of carbon as it gets flown over in an aircraft. Maybe we'll send it electronically as a PDF file. I think that's the most carbon neutral way we can do it. David, thank you on behalf of everyone
that would
here
be great.
In Australia. Thank you very much.
Thank you.